The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Brittany Packnett. Brittany is an award-winning national leader in social justice. She serves as Teach for America's Vice President of National Community Alliances, where she leads partnerships and civil rights work with communities of color. Brittany was a Ferguson protester and became a member of President Barack Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. She's the co-founder of Campaign Zero, a policy platform to end police violence. You can hear her on Crooked Media's podcast, Pod Save the People, and she recently penned the personal series Falling in Love for our friend Amy Poehler's Smart Girls. She has graced the cover of Essence magazine, been named on Time magazine's 12 New Faces of Black Leadership, to Marie Claire's New Guard, LinkedIn's Next Week, received the Peter Jennings Award for Civic Leadership, and shares the number 3 spot on Politico's 2016 50 Most Influential list. Brittany Packnett, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I was watching your TEDx St. Louis talk, and you quoted Audre Lorde, who's a writer, a feminist, and a civil rights activist, who I had actually not heard of. So I did some research, and I found another quote from her that's totally stuck with me for weeks. And she is quoted as saying, quote, "Those of us who have been forged in the crucibles of difference, those of us who are poor, who are lesbians, who are black, who are older, know that survival is not an academic skill. It is a learning how to take our differences and make them strengths." And that feels true today, just as it was when she said those words just decades earlier.
Absolutely. She is hands down one of my favorite writers in the way that she just complicates the notion of being for people right. when you are so often deemed other. People who are deemed other, folks of color, women, LGBTQIA folks, immigrants, people for whom English is not a first language, disabled people, the list goes on and on. We're so often deemed other, and then subsequently seen as one-dimensional, seen as folks who can't actually define ourselves for ourselves, which is a concept that Audre Lorde talks about all the time, but also as people for whom our differences are a detriment, right? That they are a hurdle to overcome, that they're an obstacle that we have to deal with. And so it seems ever more important, the idea now that we can take our differences and make them strengths, because it is. And that, in fact, our differences collectively are our strength, right? The idea that we can learn from divergent perspectives and different backgrounds is actually, I think, who we are, rather, at our best, instead of something that we should erase.
Yeah, it's interesting. In my field in improvisation, which was founded essentially and created by a social worker in the 20s and 30s, a woman named Viola Spolin at Jane Addams Hull House, and she devised all these improv games to get immigrant children to better assimilate. So there was this focus on being others focused. And how ironic is it that it built this art form that essentially, frankly, that I grew up in, that was very male and very white, and it's only now that it's starting to turn back into its roots as people look back to, you know, what was important about that in the first place, which was that the ensemble is one where differences are celebrated and it makes you stronger to have all these different voices.
Precisely. I mean, assimilation itself, right, is a challenging subject. And that the idea is that when you enter this space, somehow you are supposed to erase who you are, where you come from, the traditions you hold dear, and the language that you speak, and that you are supposed to look at those things like they are a detriment, like they will set you back, instead of the things that will propel you forward. I mean, we are a society that values innovation, that values people bringing a new idea, a different way of being to the forefront, But we seem to only embrace that innovation if you are white, if you are male, if you are wealthy, et cetera. So, you know, I think that it's critically important that we continue to push the boundaries of fields, whether or not it is comedy and improvisation or education or policy and everything in between, to make sure that we're actually building a space where people can not only feel welcome and be included, but where they're experiencing equitable outcomes and where everybody has the opportunity to do exactly what they want to do and be exactly who they are.
So you said in your talk that you were not raised to be intimidated. And I'm guessing that came from your parents?
Yes, that would be accurate. My parents were folks who, just shut down every single obstacle that was ever in their path. Mm-hmm. But they also really raised me to pay deeply close attention to our ancestral lineage and understanding, as I say often, that our ancestors, my ancestors as Black people, did far more than I'm looking to do with far less than I have in front of me right now. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that you can be yourself and that is not only good enough, but that yourself is that you, as you've been designed, are uniquely positioned to carry out a certain purpose in the world, is exactly how my parents raised me. And so, you know, they raised me to remember that people can shut doors, but God can always open them, and that I was designed exactly as I was supposed to be.
That's great. Yeah, I think back, I grew up in tremendous privilege, but my dad, you know, ran away from home when he was a kid and he had nothing. But he and then he ended up being like, he was basically interviewed people for a living for 33 years, and he was a really good interviewer. Yeah. And he taught me two things, and one of them is like paying attention, listening all the way through to the ends of sentences, to really understand what the person across from you is trying to say that they might not be saying. And I thought that that was an incredibly valuable thing for me, just in terms of like, God, that's a skill that I can apply to everything that, you know, beyond what I was learning, book learning in school.
It's such an important skill, especially when our culture has been reduced to what was formerly 140 characters. I guess now it's 280. And so we all find ourselves being forced to express ourselves in sound bites, right? And a minute or less if it's an Instagram video, and a soundbite if you're on television. And people's attention spans are so short now that even in our most intimate relationships, we find ourselves having to speak concisely instead of being able to kind of wander and meander and process verbally, which I often do, and have someone on the other end actually search for our intent and be curious about what's underneath what we're saying. So I think that that's incredibly important. And when I think about social justice work, having those kinds of intentional conversations where we are actively listening, especially to those voices that have traditionally been most marginalized and the most underheard, is exactly how we need to be moving forward.
Yeah, totally. All right. So the world is in like constant tumult right now. I mean, it's an hourly sort of like, who's next? You know, and I just picked up my phone and Charlie Rose has now been accused of terrible
things.
Oh my gosh.
I just saw that too.
This is like, you know, someone I grew up with who very good listener, seemingly, right? And interviewer.
Yeah.
So I'm curious for you, like, I know what I do and it's not very healthy, but like, how do you create psychological safety for yourself? Given what you're doing, who you are in the world we live in?
You know, if we want to take it back once again to Audre Lorde, she said, caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare.
Wow.
So I really frame caring for myself, again, not in this idea of indulgence, right, but in this idea that if I'm going to be here to do the work that I care about, I actually have to make sure that I'm whole and well and healthy enough to do it. And that on top of that, as a Black woman with a voice and an education, it is actually expressly antithetical to oppression that I am allowed to thrive, to persist, to do the work that is important to me, to exist at all, right? So this idea that I talk about all the time, that my mere existence is resistance, that I am not supposed to have been able to achieve the things that I have achieved, and I'm not supposed to be here. If I think about my ancestral lineage and the fact that both sides of my family were enslaved, that in and of itself is reason enough to stop and care for myself, because it is an affront to the status quo. It helps sustain me in the work that I'm trying to do in the future. You know, the first time I met the guy who's still my president, Barack Obama, it was December of 2014. It was a few months after things had started in Ferguson, and we were in the Oval Office. He was talking about the quotes on his carpet, including Dr. King's quote about the arc of the moral universe being long, but it bending toward justice. And he didn't want to talk about the bending part. He wanted to talk about the long part, because the rest of us in the office with him were all young people, and who he wanted to see in the work for a long time. And so, you know, we didn't get into this situation of real oppression, racism, sexism, et cetera, in a couple of days or years. It took us centuries, so it's going to take us a long time to create the kind of world that we want. And if I want to be around for the portion of it that is mine to pursue, then I have to take care of myself. So I really stop. I turn things off. I spend time with my family. I have no problem sitting and binging on a whole season of a sitcom, no matter how old it is, just to take my mind out of the constant churn of this news cycle, and be in control of what I'm feeding into my own brain.
Yeah, the thing I try to focus on is getting out of my fear brain, because, I mean, this is the thing that we've recognized for years at Second City, like, because we're auditioning thousands of people every year to get, like, the six slots that are going to get them on Saturday Night Live, that are going to make them famous and have their career.
Right.
And people are freaking the fuck out. They are, you know, and so, and you cannot improvise well when you're in your fear brain. That's actually, so the biggest thing that you have to do as an improviser is turn that thing off, and really great improvisers are doing that. And I thought of this way. I read a quote that you said, if they can make us scared, they can make us hate. And if they can make us hate, they win. And I love that, because it ties fear to hate. And it is. These are powerful, powerful emotions. And we're, you know, good marketers, right? And people who are trying to get elected are using fear-based tactics to get people to think of the other. It's like marketing 101. It's terrible. So you really have to arm yourself by either turning off or finding other ways to not trigger that fear brain.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I've been realizing more and more that, like, the coalitions of people who have really changed the world just have not come together based on a common hatred for something.
Right.
That might be the initial thing that brings people to the table to begin negotiating, to begin talking. But no matter how much we hate a particular politician, a particular administration, the work that we have to do is bigger than any one person or set of things, right? And so we actually have to stitch together coalitions founded in love, based on commitment to justice, based on commitment to truth, based on a commitment to the kind of world that we want to create, in order to be for something and not just against something. That's how we actually create something that lasts.
Yeah, and I thought that was really cool when I was reading about when you talk about love and power, and how that's a dyad that people don't necessarily put together, but it is the most powerful dyad. That's Gandhi, and that's King, and that's Jesus, right? Where you draw power from love, and love is your power.
I found myself, this is going to sound like such a millennial thing, but I found myself ending a lot of my, like, Twitter threads with the heart emoji and the fist emoji. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was this really quick way to symbolize, like, I am here in this work of justice because I love my people so much, and I love what we can create so much, and I love the possibility of true equity and liberation so much. But I'm going to have to use all of my power, and we're going to have to use all of our collective power in order to get there. Then I found this quote from Dr. King that, to your point, talks about love and power being critical forces in combination. He talks about the idea that love on its own is anemic and power on its own is reckless, but the two of them together are a force that can change the world in terms of the way that they inform one another. Now, I think power especially is a word that marginalized people, we shy away from all the time. Like, women don't want to be powerful, right? It is this icky thing that we've so often experienced people using against us that we just don't want to touch. I've tried to really start to take the stance of saying, no, I want to be powerful, but I want the power that I wield to be rooted in love for humanity, in love for what's possible, in love for the very best of ourselves, because that is the kind of power that actually I want to see rule the world. That is the kind of power that I know would help ensure that the kind of world we're dealing with right now is not the kind of world that will always exist. And so, yeah, together, those are things that we just really don't think about in combination. But I genuinely think those two things together will, like, unlock the force that we need to change the world.
Right. We do work with the behavioral science community up at the University of Chicago, studying behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. And what gets revealed to us over and over in the science as it relates to our practice is that it is we keep finding ourselves saying this thing, which is both things can be true, that, like over and over again, that we you know, sort of don't think that, oh, if it's like this, it can't be like that. And it's like so often in the universe, you know, the idea that it's someone I was talking to the other day was like, it's our very differences that are the thing that allow, you know, humanity to go on. You know, the coming together of different things is biological. And yet we seem so resistant to those things. So I often refer to improv as loud mindfulness, which may seem like a contradiction, but it really is. It's you have to be sort of present with the person in front of you, wholly present and focused on them, but in order to make stuff, like in a group. And that, you know, you're kind of like you're working with your system one and your system two brain. You know, you have to.
Yeah.
And so I think that's unique, but also essentially true.
I would say protest is probably loud mindfulness, too.
Yeah.
I really like that concept, right? I mean, so many people, I think, look at the act and the art of protest as something that is confrontational only and chaotic, therefore. But it is intentionally confrontational, right? Like, it brings confrontation and does what Dr. King talks about and create a crisis such that power structures are forced to pay attention. He talks about that in his letter from a Birmingham jail. But it is incredibly focused and deliberate and intentional, because we are thoughtful about our targets. We are thoughtful about what we are negotiating for once the protest has forced people to pay attention. And I'm talking about protest in the kind of very literal archetypal sense, but we talk about protest really as being telling the truth out loud and in public all the time. Mm-hmm. And so you can take the spirit of protest into lots of places, in a board meeting, right, at your city council meeting, in your house of worship, at your Thanksgiving table, because quite frankly, lots of truths are probably going to need to be told this holiday season that people are have been afraid of before now. And so this idea of telling the truth out loud and in public can feel confrontational, but it is also very intentional. And if used correctly, can be a very powerful force. So I like that idea, loud mindfulness. I think I'm gonna have to steal that. I'll credit you the first time, but
that's fine. That's cool. I've been stealing from you liberally for a while now. But it is this the idea of protest really is highly laser focused with a lot of people, and it's you know, to be effective, it has to be sort of coordinated. And you're right. I think the popular perception is that it's chaos, but it's not. It's got to be controlled. Okay, I want to talk to you about education, because you were a teacher, right?
I sure was. Taught third grade. Best grade ever.
Yeah, my wife is a college professor, so we talk a lot about education. And recently on the podcast, we talked to Jamie Cassop from Google, the chief evangelist, who was awesome. And he had a very simple but important message, which is that education disrupts poverty. And you've talked about using the new technological tools to tackle old problems, and that's what they're seemingly trying to do at Google. Tell me about, because this is clearly your roots in education are tied to your activism. So I'm curious about that line, how those connect.
Yeah, you know, I believe, and I'm gonna complicate this intentionally. I believe education can disrupt poverty. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was my father's story. He was the son of a single mother on the south side of Chicago. He was one of the first African Americans to graduate with an accounting degree from Illinois State University. Mm-hmm. Ended up going to Yale Divinity School and disrupted the cycle of poverty in his own life. You know, created a family with my mother that grew up comfortably middle class. My brother followed him to Yale Divinity, so was able to really build a legacy. But here's what I also know. By the middle of this century, it is predicted that Black and Latino families will have zero wealth, even adjusted for educational outcomes. What we also know to be true, and I found this from demos.org, is that a white high school dropout has the same amount of wealth as a Black college graduate.
Wow.
So if education alone were the only key to solving the problem of poverty beyond an individual story like my father's, then we wouldn't even be having this conversation.
Right.
Because lots of people doing good work and with excellent intentions have been throwing talent, money, solutions, technology at the educational issues. And we have to continue. Like, that's the work that I do every single day.
Mm-hmm.
But it means, though, that we have to question what kind of education we are providing if we actually want to disrupt systemic poverty. We actually want to ensure that a college degree is something like a great equalizer. We actually want to ensure that the kind of education that young people are receiving equips them not only to understand the systems that are affecting them every single day, but actually disrupt those systems and build new systems. Often we are able to train students to understand the system. More rarely, we are able to develop students to disrupt the system. It is very rare that we have students coming through our educational institutions that are informed on the system, disrupting the system, and then actually creating new equitable liberatory systems in their place. So we talk a great deal at Teach for America, and quite frankly, in a lot of the education activism circles that I work in, about the importance of culturally responsive pedagogy.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a well-researched theory of teaching that essentially says academic rigor is critically important in the classroom, as is cultural confidence and understanding and affirmation of who you are and where you come from, this idea that we were talking about earlier, that you actually don't need to assimilate to be great, but that you are already great,
yep.
And critical consciousness, a real critical understanding of the systems that you interact with and the ability to use that confidence and those academic skills together to figure out how you want to transform those systems. So imagine a world in which everyone coming out of our educational institutions were racking their brains and working together and engaging their collective leadership to solve those problems, not in the ways that we've solved them before where they just help a few more people than they did before, but where our systems are actually transformed to include and be equitable for all of us. So I think education can be can disrupt poverty, but that depends on our will to actually pursue it in a culturally responsive way.
That's really interesting. So my kids have gone through the Waldorf educational system.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I love about it is that it's very story-based. They're very much out in the elements. Like your whole deal in Waldorf is your kids have to be able to go out in any weather. So you have to sort of be able to get them warm and all that stuff. But they start reading and writing late. And this scares off a lot of parents. And the whole thing with Waldorf is like they're not ready to hold the pen. They've got to understand what the story might be and who's telling the story and what their part in the story is. And then we can get them, you know, with the pen. It's going to be fine. And like I've never seen a kid come out of Waldorf who couldn't read or write.
Sure.
But I'm also paying a lot of money for that education. And this is that's the thing I'm sort of seeing is like, how do we get that level of education and attention and this sort of beautiful community that arises around it for everyone? Because I'm not seeing that in other schools.
Yeah, and this is what you're talking about elevates the conversation on education beyond kind of these false dichotomies that people get stuck in, right? So traditional public or charter school, vouchers or no vouchers, traditionally trained teachers or alternatively trained teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the list goes on and on. If people want to have these arguments about these dichotomies that when you're a child are not real, right?
No, like no.
You want a teacher that loves you. You want a teacher that cares about you. You want a teacher that is challenging you. You want a teacher that's holding high expectations and giving you the skills and the opportunity to actually meet those expectations, whether it's indoors or outdoors, whether it's daytime, nighttime, whether it's on the computer in conversation, right, whether you're using your hands or using your brain, like whatever the way is, kids just want the opportunity to explore all of it, and that's exactly what they deserve. So I think what you're talking to really points to a conversation that is beyond any single theory of teaching, right? It is about how we actually ensure that all kids have access to the things that make them great. You know, when people talk about school choice, I often try to turn that phrase on its head. Usually when people say school choice, they're talking about charter schools and vouchers and all of these kinds of things. I have literally never met a parent or a child, and I spent a lot of time with both, who care about the governance model of a school.
Right.
They only care about whether or not their children are being serviced well, right?
Yeah.
Or served well, rather.
Mm-hmm.
So when I talk about school choice, I'm like, what would it, rich people have school choice all day long, right?
Yep. Yep.
You can send your child to a boarding school, to a Waldorf school, to a Montessori school. Mm-hmm. You can go to the public school in your neighborhood because chances are you live in a really good public school
right.
district, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
You go to a Catholic school, a Jewish school. You have school choice all day long. Suddenly we want to deny school choice to low-income young people of color because we get stuck on this idea of charter versus traditional when, in fact, excellent school choice for a kid coming from any zip code means that I can walk out of my house and I can walk to any number of places that are going to be great for me. If I've got a great talent in STEM or the arts, then there's a place for me that my family can afford that will affirm me culturally and that will set the highest expectations for me so that I can have a life of full choice and access, right?
Hmm.
What are those options that we're actually placing around kids? Because right now we're concentrating them in the wealthiest neighborhoods instead of actually thinking about how they're accessible to all. But that's not about a school type or a school governance model. That's about actually giving families the options to put their kids in an environment that is best for each child.
This is something I learn over and over when I hear you guys talk on Pod Saves the People, is that often it's we're having the wrong conversation. You know, so it's amazing
yeah.
to me how often we're all having the wrong. I guess it shouldn't be surprising to me because, you know, life's hard to live. And I see this go on in my daily interactions with human beings. But these are the most important, crucial issues facing us
yeah.
today. And we're still having the wrong conversations.
And people hate that answer, right? Because
yeah.
people really, really just want to have a simplistic conversation. People just want to say, let's pick one and move forward.
Yep.
It's the conversation that we have about police violence. You know, at Campaign Zero, we decided to build a platform, not a membership organization, and that was intentional. We decided to build a platform with 10 different policy points, 10 different policy buckets of everything from body cameras, which a lot of people think is the single solution, even though it's not, to how police union contracts are negotiated, because they're often happening in opaque circumstances, and there can be lots of public will for greater accountability and transparency, and the new union contract can come behind them and undo all of that without people even knowing, right?
Right.
So we've got all of these different issue areas, and people always ask me, well, which one or two do you really think is important to get done now? And I'm like, nope, it's all 10 of them. And this is exactly why we put all 10 of them forward, because to ask me which one or two are most important is to ask the wrong question. To focus on just one or two of them is to have the wrong conversation. We need to be figuring out how we actually build a comprehensive solutions for our greatest challenges and how we provide other people the leverage and the space and access to go and apply these solutions to what works in their community. And that's why we built a platform and not a membership organization. DeRay, Sam, and myself, we're the planning team for Campaign Zero. We were just in Dallas at a mega church down there talking about Campaign Zero and the work that they could do in the Dallas community. But ultimately, if you never follow any of us on Twitter, if you never meet any of us or hear any of us speak, you should be able to go to joincampaignzero.org, see our platform, download the materials and the research that we've done on your community, and actually get together with activists and change makers in your community and create that change there. And so we wanted to make that easy, user-friendly, and accessible for people in such a way that didn't depend on some kind of hierarchy or some kind of due that you had to pay, but that you are really equipped to go and pursue this change on your own so that you can declare in your community what the right conversation is and what the right solution is, given your content.
Earlier today, I got sent these questions because I'm speaking at a learning conference in Florida next year, and I feel like such an imposter because like a really cool lineup, like with like the Heath brothers and Zoe Chance from Yale, I'm talking about improvisation. And one of the questions they asked me is, "Hey, technology is so important to learning. You know, what do you think about that?" And I decided to answer honestly, which is like I have a love-hate relationship with technology because I understand the power of technology to provide access and information to a lot of people. But at the end of the day, I really believe we're not going to accomplish anything unless human beings can figure out how to work with human beings. And one of the things that I think certainly social media has done, and these problems have existed forever, so I know that. We haven't solved them before, but social media isn't helping us in the nuance game. In fact, it's going the other way.
Sure.
I really wonder, like 10 or 15 years from now, are we going to look back at this period and be like, oh, Jesus, like, where were the seatbelts for our phones? Because you've got that opposite effect where it's like now everything's being reduced to these characters and these insults.
Yeah.
Or these phrases, and so that, and everyone wants their, like, give me 3 points. It's like, it's not 3 points, it's 10 points, and you have to pay attention to all of them, and by the way, they change when you mix them around, so yeah, it's hard. I don't know.
I also, no, I agree with you. You know, I think that there are lots of virtues of technology, but like you've already said, two things can be true, and I think this is a both and, right? That there needs to be real emphasis on quality human interaction as well as real technical literacy, especially for people from low-income communities. But I think even beyond what you're saying, which I agree with, I find that a lot of people are figuring out how to talk about something and not how to actually do something.
Mm.
Right? Like, people have figured out how to use all the right words, all the right rhetoric to make you sound super woke, like super engaged. And then when it comes time to actually build something that helps change the world, that helps create equity for people, folks are just stuck because you spent all of your energy on your rhetoric and you spent none of your energy on your output. It feels like everybody's managing a brand.
Yes.
And it's like, here are my values and here's my brand and here's my color scheme and here's who I talk to and here's what I wear and here's where I go and here's the message that I'm trying to get out to the world. And that is fine as a first step. But once you get that message out to the world, what are you leaving the world with that outlasts you? Because if it's just a brand, that is actually quite, like, that is sinking sand, right? It is not going to last you, and it's not actually going to help build anything for anybody else. So I worry that we're so focused on kind of the veneer of who we are that we're not spending any real time on who we actually are, who we want to be, and what we want to create.
I wonder if all the terrible things that are happening right now, I tend to be an optimistic person, and so part of me is like, is this the last gasp? Did we just elect a brand that's like so empty that we're just have to face it? And all these people, like, we believed in this brand that these people were good people, but they're terrible sexual predators. And so all this stuff is happening so that we can get down to the work. I mean, this is my dream. I've got kids, you know, I've got a 20-year-old and a 15-year-old who I think are so cool and so smart and really have good values and want to help change the world. And I feel like, maybe this is just the last gasp, and we're setting up for all the good stuff that's going to come later.
Yeah, I'm hoping so. It does certainly feel like there's been some real shifts, right? I mean, the conversation around sexual harassment is an important example of that. Yeah. I do think, it's hard, right? Because it feels like I feel like I'm just bracing for the day that, like, my favorite rapper, my favorite actor, my favorite journalist, my favorite whatever gets accused by 26 different women of sexual harassment. And I'm like, it's coming, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
The rules do not change for that person just because I liked their product or their creativity or whatever. Like, the rules do not change for that person. But I know that it's coming. And, like, that forces me to ask myself, what does this reckoning actually mean for the future, right? Because it's not like there is a pervasive culture of sexual harassment, just like there's a pervasive culture of benevolent racism, right? Some people call it hipster racism, right? Just like there's a cult, like, there are so many ways in which we have either we've either become better at hiding our problematic cultural issues, or we have, like, put them under a veneer of humor that, like, this time right now is forcing us to reckon with all of them, and it's just going to make us question who we want to be in the future. Because at the end of the day, I know a lot of men who do not fully understand consent. Like, I know a lot of men who in this moment have been sitting there going, like, how do I raise my son right now? And how do I also think about that time when I may have, like, made a woman uncomfortable and didn't even realize it because I thought I was just hitting on her and it was fine, right?
Right.
Or, like, actually, I'm second-guessing the way that I interacted with that woman last week at work because I thought I was just making a joke, and now I realize that this actually is really problematic and I probably made her deeply uncomfortable, right? Are all of those people monsters? maybe, maybe not. But there is a conversation to be had for all of us about how we actually root out that kind of culture where that kind of behavior was pervasive and where no one was ever held accountable for it, right? So the permissiveness of the culture that laid underneath it all is exactly why we are having a new revelation, what feels like a new revelation every single day, although this stuff has been going on for a long time. And so the question for me is not like, what am I going to do when my phase is suddenly the one that's being accused? It's what are we collectively doing such that the culture is no longer like this, so that like, you actually just, this is not the norm, right? This is not the normal way to operate, so that there won't be a future of, we won't look 20 years on the line and have another series of revelations in a really tough year, because we've actually like rooted out the cancer in that.
I was reading this piece the other day that was kind of taking on the idea around deliberate practice, which was has been a popular concept. And this guy sort of challenged it and said he believes in deliberate experimentation. And I'm sort of like, that's what improvisation is. It allows you to sort of portray a character with someone else, say the wrong thing, not die because of it, not be shamed because of it, but be able to sort of pivot out of it or find a new way. And I feel like, you know, that was you. That used to be youth. You know, you'd be able to all do these stupid things.
Yeah.
Like this is what this. I was just talking about with Elif, our producer, about this. It was like the sexual harassment stuff. I'm like, that's the shit I learned in high school and college, making the awkward pass or not knowing to, or kind of saying something wrong, and then feeling like, oh my god, I never want to do it that way again, because experiential learning is the best learning. You know. So have we built this image factory where people aren't willing to experiment at a certain age to learn this stuff over and over again? And do we need to have essentially more practice in just the art of being a human being? Are we too, you know, and this is my fear about the digital stuff, is that now less and less people, they can live their lives without talking to someone, without, you know, my daughter one time said she had a friend who would only argue with her over text. And I'm like, no.
I think your daughter and I have the same friend.
Okay, you might. And I'm just like, don't do it. Don't do it, because she's going to say something terrible and she can't see that look on your face that will, she'll then decide, I never want to say that again to someone.
And so, you lose inflection and you lose, so much is lost in translation that way. I will push a bit, though, and say, I think that youth was a safe time to experiment in certain cases, right? I think that for young people who grew up in more challenging circumstances, right, there was just considerably more risk. But when you talk about improv as an example of this, there's also the consideration that improv provides some clear rules and guide rails, right? And so it's like, it is happening in a fixed time, at a fixed place, with people that you know and in theory have at least some kind of knowledge of who they are, right?
And there's a contract
with them. There's a literal and social contract that you're engaging in when you are doing that kind of deliberate experimentation in improv. And perhaps that is instructional for us as we not only find solutions for education, teach young people how to engage in human interaction, but quite frankly for all of us, like adults and kids as well, to figure out how to build those thick spaces that can be simultaneously safe and brave. You know, I do a lot of work in kind of racial justice education, right? So having people walk through some very difficult concepts around racial identity development and racism and structural oppression and all of these kinds of things. Those are very personal conversations for people, and they feel super high stakes, right?
Yep.
You sit there and you're like, oh crap, if I say the wrong thing, I'm going to be labeled as a racist for the rest of my life, or I'm going to be labeled as an angry black woman for the rest of my career here. I'm going to be labeled as, you know, whatever, right? We presume all of these labels that are wrapped with fear because we don't feel like we can deliberately experiment in that way. And so a lot of times in those spaces, we will intentionally set up space that might be single gender or racial affinity groups, right, where white folks are together and people of color are together, to be able to actually put some of that stuff out in a slightly safer space, experiment with it, have people react to it in a space that not only is safer for you, but that won't injure other people, and then come back together with what you equipped with what you learned and actually take different action and engage in a different kind of conversation.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Okay, I'm keeping you way long, so I'm going to ask you for your yes and story, but I first want to ask, you just did a bunch of live events with the Pod Guys, right?
Yeah.
All right. So, like, what? I couldn't see this, right? I just listened to it. But here's what I imagine that's in front of you. Just a sea of well-meaning white faces. Is that not the case? Was it more diverse than that?
I'd say it was fairly diverse. It was pretty white. But here's what I mean it when I say it's going to take all of us to win. Mm-hmm. And there are some times when it makes sense for me to be talking to a room full of people of color. There are some times when it makes sense for me to be like providing encouragement to a room full of black women like myself. And there are other times when it makes sense to be a provocative, kind of stirring voice in a room full of white people or men or privileged people in some form or fashion.
Yeah.
Because, like, those folks need to be brought along, too. And I know that if they were present, they were ready and wanted that conversation, right? They were seeking that kind of conversation out.
Yeah.
And so, even if it is a sea of white folks, I tend toward the side of being thankful that they're there and want to be a part of that conversation, want to learn, want to do better, want to grow, want to teach other people. Because if the audience were a bunch of folks who already agreed with us, then we actually wouldn't be doing any important work.
Right. All right. Your glass is half full. I like that. All right. So I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. So in the idea of improvisation, right, you can't do anything if you say no. And if you say yes, but that's like, you know, no with a bow tie. It's not cool. You say yes and. You sort of affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if from your life and your past or your work, you have a yes and story for us.
You know, you mentioned in my introduction that I was a member of President Obama's 21st Century Policing Task Force.
Yeah.
And it might look in retrospect like that was an automatic yes. It was certainly an incredible opportunity, and I'm just deeply thankful to have been a part of it. But it was not at all an automatic yes.
Mm-hmm.
There were lots of folks in the activist community who just felt like this is going to be another task force, another commission that's not going to do anything. It's going to be a bunch of elites sitting around the table ignoring what's happening for real people in real communities, what's happening on the street, and what the real risk is for our young people. There were folks who had issues with that particular administration and said, don't sit at the table, don't go in the house, mm-hmm. You got to stay on the street. So there were parts of me that said, do you actually want to say yes to this? Is this thing going to be real? And what I decided to say was yes, and I'm going to ensure that it's real.
Hmm.
The good news is that there were lots of people that had made the same choice, including, I would say, the president, people like Valerie Jarrett, others, who came to the table saying, we do not want this to be the production of a report that sits on a shelf and gets dusty. We actually want to provoke change in the space of law enforcement. We want to provoke progress in the space of police violence and justice in communities. But so the yes and for me was yes, and I'm always going to tell the truth, no matter how uncomfortable it makes folks. So there were many times when I was sitting right next to President Obama and had to say things that were really uncomfortable, had to say things that lots of other folks would have advised against. To his credit, I think he showed that he would have rather heard those things than the kind of cute, expedient things that other people would have had me say. So the yes and for me was to always embody that spirit of protest, to tell the truth out loud and in the public space of that task force. And we spent, several months going all around the country, hearing and learning from members of the community, victims of police violence, law enforcement officers, activists, academics and researchers on this issue, and the 11 of us on the actual task force, and there were things that came out of that report that I had myself and a few others had to really hold firm on, right? Like mm-hmm. things like independent and external investigations in cases of police violence instead of having the police themselves. That I was like, look, we're not going to get off the phone until we figure out how to make sure that this is in the report.
Mm-hmm.
So the yes and for me was always showing up, always telling the truth, no matter how uncomfortable, no matter how much my voice might shake, and being committed to making this thing real, even if people didn't think it was possible.
And both things ended up being true.
Both things absolutely ended up being true. We've seen a lot of action on task force recommendations. Some of those recommendations are in Campaign Zero, and so we've seen some of those recommendations through the work of Campaign Zero actually enacted in state legislatures and in individual police departments. A lot of the members of the task force are still doing a lot of work inside and outside of the law enforcement community, equipping people with these recommendations and the information and data they're in so that people can make change right there on the ground. There are 18,000 police departments in the country, so the work is going to take a long time, but we see a lot more people taking these things seriously and adopting a lot of these practices because we came and we committed to making it real.
Brittany Packnett, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.
Down.